Chapter 12.
Almost there. Almost. Almost done.
Skippy lifted his voice above the whisper the pilots had been using. Okay, you are now below the sensor field coverage in the shadow of that mountain range. You are free to maneuver. Your stealth field will conceal you from detection.
I'm picking up active sensor pulses, Reed noted with concern.
Oh, yeah. The Bosphorok know this area presents a security risk as a gap in their sensor field coverage, so they have active sensors on the mountain ridge sweeping the area. They're sort of like motion sensors, something like that. Do not worry. The Falcon's stealth field, enhanced by the incomparable awesomeness of me, is concealing you quite effectively. So long as you fly a smooth course, I can predict the pattern of sensor pulses coming at you, and I can proactively feed back the return pulse their sensor system expects from an empty valley floor. That sensor system will see only what I want it to see, which is nothing. Okay, you see the landing zone through that low spot in the ridge? The hatch closed with a clang Reed felt rather than heard, her helmet being sealed as a safety measure. That sound was the closing of the outer airlock door as the last of the assault team stepped out onto the moon's surface. Reed and Beezer were alone, with the Falcon parked at the bottom of a steep-sided narrow ravine. The active sensor system did not penetrate into the ravine's depth, and the stealth field wrapped around the ship protected it from the prying eyes of satellites orbiting the moon. The ravine had been chosen as a landing site not only because the sensor network did not cover the area, it also had a valuable feature that the amazing Skippy could not match. The rock floor of the canyon was almost free of the gray dust that covered the moon's surface. No stealth field could conceal dust kicked up by the Falcon's belly jets, so the craft had to land in an area relatively free of the fine dust that stuck to every surface of the airless miniature world. Cameras on the outside of the Falcon showed its skids and belly were already tinted faintly gray by the dust, and the away team's boots also would have been coated by dust adhering by static cling, except the Krestang armor had a handy-dandy feature that repelled the dust. The small amount of dust swirling in the ravine could still be detected by satellites, so the mission had been timed to coincide with the harmless impact of a small meteor near the area. That small meteor had been captured by one of the Falcon dropships 4 days ago and guided on a course to impact the moon at the appropriate time. When the satellites noticed dust floating above the ravine, that phenomena would be dismissed as being caused by a rock slide triggered by the meteor impact and ignored.
What's next? Reed's co-pilot asked, twisting in his seat to get comfortable.
Reed considered that for a moment. The away team was already beyond the Falcon's stealth field, so they could not be seen except for through the synthetic vision provided by the alien AI who was oddly named Skippy.
Now, I'm going to use a real bathroom, she announced as she popped the seal on her helmet and lifted it off her head. The closer Smythe's team gets to the objective, the more likely it is they'll need a fast evac, so this is the time for housekeeping here. We'll get everything set up for immediate dust-off.
She smiled at the term that was ironically appropriate.
And we will continually update a flight plan for picking up the away team as they progress toward the objective. If Smythe calls for help, we should not have to think about what to do.
Right.
Beezer turned his attention back to his console. Having a continually updated what-if plan was sound practice for any pilot. If an engine went out at 35,000 feet over the Rocky Mountains, the pilot should already have landing fields selected and revise those selections as the flight progressed. Even without mechanical failure creating complications, a pilot should have a radio ready for the frequency of the next controller along the flight path, reducing the workload when crossing that imaginary boundary. If Smythe's team got into trouble on the current mission, it was unlikely the Falcon could do anything to help them, or even to help itself. But with nothing else to do while the Falcon sat wrapped in a stealth field, running through what-if scenarios was a useful exercise. Reed not only used the Falcon's tiny bathroom, she took time to partly remove her flight suit, apply a cream to an area on her left hip where the suit had been irritating her skin, put the suit back on, and make coffee for her and Beezer.
Thank you.
He beamed at her briefly before his face returned to the neutral expression of intense focus as he used his console to run a simulation of a flight to attack the moon base if that disastrous scenario ever happened. The Falcon did not have a prayer of surviving such an attack. The only purpose of an attack would be to cover a retreat by the ground team. In effect, the pilots would be trading their 2 lives for 10,
a trade Beezer would make if absolutely necessary. What made the scenario particularly sour was the knowledge that regardless what happened to the Falcon, Smythe's ground team would be unlikely to return to the ship. 12 lives would be lost, not 10, and all for nothing. He paused the simulation as Reed ducked down to avoid the low overhead in the cockpit and wriggled into her seat. The original much-too-small Theranan seats had been ripped out and replaced by couches that could fit humans. That was a great improvement in terms of length, but Skippy's redesign had not been able to do much with the narrow width, and pilots learned to keep their elbows up to avoid bashing into the consoles on either side. Getting in and out of the couches required gymnastic moves that made Reed grateful for the moon's low gravity.
6 potential sites for evac, Beezer pointed at the display between couches. None of them are good. The first 5 allow us to hug the mountains and stay out of active sensor coverage until we have to return for final approach. Then we'll be exposed over this flat, open terrain. The only cover out there.
He meant inside the vast, shallow crater that housed the enemy base.
Is this little ridge right here. To use that cover, we will need to fly all the way around this ridge.
He indicated the lunar mountain range that currently hid them.
That takes another 7 minutes of flight time.
Reed shook her head while blowing on the super-hot coffee.
I don't like that. If Smythe needs evac, he'll need it right away. If they're here,
she highlighted a circle within 2 kilometers of the base,
it would take a miracle for us to pick them up. The whole bottom of that crater is dust, knee-deep or more. Our jets would kick up a fountain the stealth field could never conceal. We may as well drop stealth and send up a flare announcing our presence. I say we forget about planning an evac anywhere out in that crater.
Works for me, Beezer agreed.
20 minutes later, they had 5 flight paths planned that allowed at least a chance for the Falcon to pick up the ground team and survive for a return flight to the Flying Dutchman. The flying would be tricky, and the routes very restricted, because the micro-wormhole was with the ground team, and the Falcon could not rely on a magical beer can fooling enemy sensors.
I think...
Samantha Reed relaxed back in her seat and sipped the last of the coffee.
That covers everything.
She was wrong. 3 minutes later, Skippy called,
Hey, are the two of you bored? I can load crossword puzzles on your consoles if you like.
No.
Reed was already irritated with the beer can, who rarely left her alone.
We are not bored. We've been planning potential sites to pick up the ground team if needed.
Huh. Let me look at your work.
Good, good, yup, good work. Looks like you have just about covered all possible scenarios.
Thank you.
Except, you know, for the scenario you actually do need to run right now, or in a minute, when Colonel Smythe calls you.
Damn it.
Reed looked for a place to stow her coffee mug, but one feature the Falcon lacked was cup holders. With one hand, she restarted power flow to the main engines, while with the other hand, she drained the dregs of her mug and tucked it in a mesh bag under the seat.
What happened?
Well, this is kind of a funny story. There is nothing funny about any of this. Oh, I meant it is funny for me, because I am safe and warm aboard the Flying Dutchman. And hey, it'll be funny for you too, years later, when you're looking back on these golden times of adventure, if you survive, of course. That's looking kind of unlikely right now, so...
Reed bit back a curse word and focused on the facts.
What is the problem?
Well, this is ironic, in the true meaning of ironic. The two of you thought you had accounted for every possibility for retrieving the ground team, but you assumed the ground team would stick to their assigned route. That is not happening. Smythe right now is... I just told him that I am explaining the problem to you. Right now, the ground team is here, and they are proceeding to climb this ridge into the valley to the north.
The route was highlighted on the display.
You need to pick them up in this valley.
That is going to be very delicate flying. There is an active sensor beacon on top of this hill here, right above that valley.
After you pick up the ground team,
see what I did there? I said after instead of if to boost your confidence. Although, sheesh, good luck with that, he muttered.
Anywho, after a miracle happens and you flying monkeys pick up Smythe's team, you need to fly back along nearly the same route and drop them off here.
She peered at the display.
We're flying this complicated route just to relocate the ground team by...
She connected the 2 dots, and the map showed her the distance was a mere 7 kilometers.
7 clicks. They can't just walk there?
No, they can't. Crossing that distance would require transiting an area of deep dust. The ground team's passage would kick up too much dust for their portable stealth field to conceal. Plus, they would have to climb and descend this steep ridge. The ground team could do all that, just not quickly enough. The source of the problem is that crawler from the moon base decided to take a route different from the one I expected. Big jerks, he grumbled. Those bird brains followed the same route every other day for the past 7 weeks, but are they doing that today? No, of course not. That would make Skippy's life way too easy. I hate the freaking universe. The two pilots shared a disgusted look. Beezer spoke first.
Yes, Skippy, because it is all about you.
Wow, you understand that? Oh, this is great. Usually it takes me months to train a new monkey to have the proper respect for my awesome... Hey, you jerk. You were being sarcastic. I should...
You think? Reed interrupted. We need to reposition the ground team so they can intercept that crawler.
Maybe I don't feel like telling you. The beer can pouted.
Mr. Skippy, Beezer shot a warning glance at Reed. Please ignore my rudeness. We're under stress, and truthfully, your awesome presence is a bit overwhelming for us poor monkeys,
he finished while crossing two fingers of his right hand, hoping the beer can would not look through the cockpit flight recorder video.
Huh, Skippy sniffed.
Well, Beezer, that is the proper attitude. I accept your apology. Yes, the ground team needs to be relocated so they can intercept the crawler. Smythe debated whether to walk back to your Falcon and wait 2 days for the next crawler trip, but 2 days cooped up in that little dropship would reduce his team's effectiveness, and I told him there is no guarantee the crawler will resume its original route. Plus, every second you are there risks exposure. The base commander could decide to conduct a combat or search and rescue drill and send space fighters over your location. Smythe wants to go now, and Uber said they couldn't help him, so it's up to you.
Reed bit back a retort. We need the beer can. We need the beer can, she told herself.
Understood. The flight was almost impossible because the micro-wormhole was in Smythe's backpack. Without Skippy to fool the active sensor beams, the Falcon's flight path needed to hug steep-sided mountain slopes, hover in shadows until sensor beams passed by, then dart across the gap to hover again. Twice their belly jets kicked up small pockets of dust on ledges or hidden in crevices. They held their breath as the statically charged particles hung suspended over the airless surface, but no alarm was sounded. By the time they set the Falcon down ever so gently to avoid being detected by enemy sensors that could pick up the ground shaking from thumping the craft down in a rough landing, both pilots were shaking from the strain. Half an hour later, their backs inside their flight suits were still damp from sweat as the ground team approached. Smythe was first through the Falcon's airlock. Taking his helmet off, he offered a grim expression, but Reed beat him to the punch. Wagging a finger, she scolded the SAS man.
Did you forget your lunches again? You kids never learn.
Smythe's lips turned upward in a tight grin.
Someone, he jerked his head toward the airlock, forgot to use the bathroom before we left. Skippy tells me the flying you just did was exceptional. Thank you.
The next leg of the flight was slightly less stressful, but only because the nerves of the pilots were not capable of being more jangled than they already were. A complication was the only place to land the Falcon was a ledge of rock jutting out from the mountainside, and the approach of the crawler meant there was no time to fly an egress route after dropping off the ground team. The Falcon would need to rest on the ledge, in full view of the crawler, as it drove by less than a half kilometer away. If the stealth field failed, or if the crew of the crawler happened to look closely in the direction of the ledge, they could not fail to notice something amiss. Skippy had tuned the enhanced stealth field to pulse between frequencies so dust would not be attracted to the static generated by the field. But after time, there was nothing the beer can could do to prevent dust from clinging to the field like an invisible dome.
Right, let's try this again, shall we?
Smythe attached his helmet once more in the Falcon's crowded cabin. The timing was difficult. The enemy crawler was moving quickly toward the landing zone, and Smythe needed to get his team away from the Falcon and into position with little slack in the schedule. He would have preferred to pump air out of the cabin and lower the back ramp so his team could all exit at the same time, rather than two at a time through the side airlock. Skippy had vetoed that idea because the pumps in the cabin were not efficient at getting all the air out, and if they popped the back ramp, there was a good chance enemy sensors would notice the oddity of nitrogen and oxygen gas drifting over the airless moon's surface.
Skippy,
You are certain the crawler will follow the expected route?
I had not thought of that. I guess the crawler actually has multiple routes it could take before it gets to that low spot in the ridge ahead. I kind of assumed the driver would take the most direct, fastest route.
Smythe paused, hand ready to swing his faceplate down.
You do not bloody know. We might have to do this a third time if the driver decides to take a holiday to see the sights along the way.
Hey, how am I supposed to know what some bird brain is thinking? Now that I consider it, there is a route that would take that crawler within 15 meters of the Falcon. That would be bad.
Perhaps you should keep your fingers crossed that driver is in a hurry.
5, 4, 3. Smythe counted down 5 seconds to control his anger.
Can you estimate the odds the crawler will take the direct route, please?
Sure. That is a simple math problem.
Not so simple. Colonel Smythe, I am pleased to tell you the odds are a solid schmaybe in your favor, I think. It's hard to say.
Smythe pondered the fact that the Flying Dutchman still carried 12 tactical nuclear weapons in a cargo bay. Perhaps if the beer can was placed between them and all 12 detonated, he could daydream about that pleasant thought later.
Is being aboard a crawler a sought-after assignment?
He was wondering whether crews stuck underground at that moon base might compete to get aboard the crawler for some time away from the routine.
No, Skippy answered, surprised by the odd question. No, crews generally hate being made to take a crawler out on this particular assignment. The route they have to drive is dull and mostly does not provide good views of anything interesting. Plus, they have to get out 14 times to check sensor domes, and the work of inspecting sensor equipment is painstaking and tedious. Why does morale of crawler crews matter to you?
Because, Smythe lowered his faceplate with confidence. Crews that dislike an assignment will wish to get it over with quickly. The driver is very likely to take a direct route. One last question, please. The crawler has 2 Bosphorok aboard. Are they new to the assignment?
No. Why do you want to know?
Oh, you are thinking that bird brains who have not been on that assignment for a while might be more likely to engage in sightseeing. That is good meat sack thinking. I can assure you the crew roster tells me that the 2 people in that crawler are considered knuckleheads by their commander. She has assigned them to that duty 9 times in a row. As a punishment.
Brilliant. Star Team Alpha, we are a go. Again.
Katie Frey lay prone on the gray rock, not moving a muscle. Except for the muscles alongside her nose, she had an itch there and couldn't scratch it through the helmet faceplate. It was less distracting to wiggle her nose than to let the itch drive her crazy. The reason she could not move was that the team's portable stealth field generator was not extended over her, and her prone form was covered with stealth netting that had been placed around her by another team member. The last members of the team were across the crawler route from her position. She could just barely detect the stealth field that concealed them by a very faint shimmer where the field's edges touched the ground. The ambush site had been chosen largely because that shelf of hard rock was relatively free of the gray dust that coated the entire moon. The team did not leave deep boot prints behind them. As they walked, each person dragged behind them a sweeper that smoothed out the shallow tracks they made and applied a charge that made the dust want to cling to the moon's surface rather than churning in swirls. Virtual testing by Skippy showed the sweepers could not erase tracks more than a few millimeters deep, so the ambush site and the route from the Falcon to the ambush had been chosen to avoid deep layers of dust. After a minute, and with only 9 minutes to spare before the crawler would come around a spur of the ridge and into view, the portable stealth field turned off, and Katie's enhanced synthetic vision could not see any other members of the team. For the critical phase of the ambush, there would be no communications between the team. Not even low-powered line-of-sight laser burst transmissions. Mission success relied on every member of the team knowing and performing their assigned task, and the team as a whole relied on Katie to do her task first and do it correctly. The reason Katie had all the pressure on her was the method of stopping the enemy crawler without the 2-person crew realizing there was anything suspicious had been her idea. The original plan had been for a sniper to shoot a tread, forcing the crawler to a halt. The crew would then get outside to examine and fix the problem, allowing the concealed star team to take them out.
Skippy's response to that plan was scathing, pointing out that the crawler had external cameras and the crew could easily tell the treads had been impacted by a rifle round or maser beam or some other type of hostile force. When the crew saw they had been shot at, the last thing they would do is get out of their vehicle, and they would activate the crawler's automated defenses that were targeted by sensitive motion sensors. The autocannons of the crawler could shred the team as soon as they moved. Whatever plan they used, it could not allow any significant external damage to the crawler, or the crawler would not be allowed inside the base's garage for the team to infiltrate the enemy facility. Smythe and Bishop were at a standstill in planning when Katie, on her own initiative, studied diagrams of the crawler vehicle. Slung underneath for easy access were spare treads, flexible-toothed belts the treads attached to, jacks and pads, basically everything a crew needed to swap out a busted tread quickly. Katie suggested the ship's fabricators could create a duplicate tread and belt, which could be placed where the crawler would run over it and get tangled. Looking out through the external cameras, the crew would curse the idiot crew of a previous crawler who had lost part of their gear, but they would not be suspicious of enemy activity, so they would go outside to remove the obstruction. Katie had been pleased with herself until Smythe gently pointed out the flaw in her plan. They could not be sure precisely which route the crawler would travel, and anyway, the crawler's forward sensors would detect the obstruction and maneuver around it. Laying several sets of treads and belts so the crawler could not avoid becoming entangled would certainly arouse suspicion. Basically, the senior star officer and the alien AI had patted her on the head and somewhat condescendingly told her nice try, but her plan would not work. So she had talked with the matronly ship AI the crew called Nagatha. That AI had been sympathetic and ran through several concepts until Katie had a foolproof plan. When Colonel Bishop flashed his charming grin and an enthusiastic thumbs up at her, she knew they had a workable plan for that phase of the difficult operation. She also felt for the first time since she came aboard that she might, just might, actually belong in the elite merry band of pirates. That was why she was alone under stealth netting, lying prone on cold lunar rock, trying to control her breathing and deal with her itchy nose while she waited to play her critical part in the operation. "Be careful what you ask for, Katie," she told herself. "You might get more than you can handle." Maybe she could not handle the pressure. What was she doing on an alien moon thousands of light-years from home? Maybe she should have stayed. No. She recognized her feelings of doubt as nothing more than pre-race jitters, the butterflies she got in her stomach before the starting gun or horn sounded. That thought was confirmed when the nose of the crawler came around a corner, and all her nervous tension melted away to the back of her mind. She had a job to do, and the sudden calm that washed over her gave her confidence that she could handle any last-minute complications. Complications like the crawler veering abruptly from the straight course it had followed since rounding the corner. There wasn't anything Katie could see that would have caused the driver to... Oh, there it was. A pothole filled in with dust that the crawler's forward sensors must have detected at the last moment, swerving the vehicle to protect the treads. Were there any potholes in the rocky path in front of Katie? She did not remember any. But then she had been walking under the spooky ultra-darkness of a portable stealth field. The ground in front of her had been illuminated only by lights attached to the waist of her suit, and that light had been weirdly bent and distorted. Without her suit computer to interpret the images for her, she would not have recognized her own boots. The light-bending effect was disturbing enough when the field was static, but when it moved along with the two people carrying the device, the result was visual chaos. No matter. The crawler was moving along the expected path, and soon would be opposite her position, its cheery bright blue sides exposed and vulnerable. She was lying in between two rocks, with only a thin wire poking above the stealth netting to provide a view, which her suit computer fed to her faceplate and the scope of her modified Kristang rifle. The narrow gap between rocks caused her to be wedged in uncomfortably, with comfort given the least consideration. The position was perfect, for it provided a clear view of the exact spot where the crawler would fall into shadow by the jagged peaks above. That transition line, between the intense brightness of sunlight and the cold darkness of shadow, would be the most difficult area for enemy satellites overhead to get clear images of, and fooling enemy sensors was the key to the whole plan. Positioning the portable stealth field generator was the trickiest part of the operation. In the event that the crawler moved away from Katie's position, there was a backup sniper on the other side of the track with instructions to fire only if the crawler rolled on past an imaginary line that represented the limit of Katie's effective field of fire. The second sniper provided a backup if the crawler moved on either side of the track by about a quarter kilometer. What the team did not have a backup for was the amazing technology of the portable stealth field. Following Skippy's instructions, the two men carrying the heavy unit had placed it in the optimal place to envelop the crawler, but only if the crawler did not vary too much along its course toward the gap in the mountain ridge ahead. The synthetic view projected on the inside of Katie's faceplate had imaginary lines showing where the crawler had to be in relation to the stealth field, or the operation would be called off and the team would let the crawler roll past, unaware of its narrow and lucky escape. The team would then regroup to try again. Fortunately, the crawler was sticking closely to the route used by previous crawlers, the tracks they had made outlined clearly in the harsh sunlight. As it approached, Katie confirmed it was within the green lines of optimal positioning for the stealth field to cover. As the crawler drew closer to the target area, Katie did not hear the crackling burst of static that was the designated abort code. She did not think anything dramatic like, "We're really doing this," or "Here we go," or "God, please do not let me screw this up." She did not think anything at all, with her mind calm and entirely focused. The amazing targeting optics of her Krestang suit and rifle not only showed her precisely the tread she selected, they provided a feature where she could designate that tread, and the rifle would automatically follow it. The electric nanomotors built into the rifle moved the muzzle slightly independently of the stock she held, keeping focus on the tread she had selected. It was almost startling when the rifle fired a mere second after she pressed the trigger to authorize the weapon. What shot out from the rifle was a round specially fabricated by Skippy's bots. The round was low velocity so that the device impacted the crawler without a sharp sound that would startle the crew. What the blank round launched was not a weapon, but a heavy object that, when folded up, was the size of a tennis ball. As it got within 10 meters of the targeted tread, the device unfolded, colliding with the designated tread just as it rolled under the crawler, and immediately became entangled, jamming the tread. To protect the entire tread assembly, the crawler automatically ground to a halt. That was Katie's entire part of the operation to capture the crawler, for the modifications to her rifle temporarily rendered it unable to fire anything other than the specialized ammo to disable the alien vehicle. Her part of the operation had been entirely successful.
"Success!" Skippy shouted into Smythe's ear loudly enough to make him wince. "This confirms my suspicion that Joe's supposed brilliant cleverness is nothing special. All you monkeys are capable of dreaming up inventive plans."
Smythe smiled despite his intense focus on the operation.
"Are you saying that all humans are capable of doing something you can't do?"
"What? Oh, you limey bastard! I hate you so much!"
"Quiet, please. Sit, Rep."
"Fine," the beer can huffed.
"Why do you have to ask me about the situation? I'm feeding the data to your suit. You can watch all the spine-tingling action on your faceplate."
"Because while you're providing a play-by-play report, you are not making an arse of yourself and annoying me."
"Oh, good point. That is fair, I guess. Not much is going on yet. The crew just turned off power to the tread motors and..." "They followed proper procedure to disconnect power flow so they can work on the treads."
"Hee hee! They are indeed cursing the previous crew who they suspect of losing their gear and not reporting it. I wonder if the base charges crew for lost gear. That would be a good incentive not to report anything missing. Anyway, they just called the base, or they tried to, because of course I am intercepting all signals. The base duty officer, meaning me, asked them how long of a delay there will be this time, implying those knuckleheads are expected to screw up. I was grumpy about it, too. That should make the crawler crew eager to get the job done fast. And, yes, they just stepped into the airlock. I am now engaging the stealth field to cover the crawler. Field strength is good. Wait for it. Wait. Okay, we're good. None of the satellites sounded an alarm when the stealth field engaged, and their real view of the crawler was replaced by the view I want them to see, because I am awesome!" he sang. Continuing the play-by-play as requested, the outer airlock door is cycling open. We now pause for a word from our sponsor. He switched to a phony used car salesman voice.
Skippy's patented awesomeness pills can make you awesome. Although, let's face it, making you even meh would be a freaking miracle. So,
Skippy.
Okay, damn, you are just like Buzzkill Joe. You never let me have any fun. Well, Tweedledum and Tweedledumass are now stepping down onto the surface and walking back toward...
Oh, no. The quarterbacks are down. A smashing tackle. Double play. Two outs.
I think you're mixing metaphors there.
Ah, whatever. You Brits don't play American football or baseball anyway, so it's all Greek to you. Both knuckleheads are dead. Those were superb shots by your team. You should congratulate them. After, you know, you move your ass because we are running out of time. Full comms are now available.
ST Alpha, good show, Smythe announced in a typically understated monotone as he rose to his feet, being careful not to move faster than the sweeper behind him could cope with the voids he was leaving and the fine layer of dust.
Execute cleanup.
In his synthetic vision, he could see all members of the team rising and proceeding toward the crawler, moving deliberately as they had been trained. No one moved with undue speed, and there were no wasted motions. He noted that the Canadian sniper paused as she neared the crawler to stoop and pick up the discarded shell that had covered the special munition she had fired. Without being told, she walked backward, then forward again over the spot where the shell had fallen and tumbled in the dust, the sweeper dragging behind her, smoothing out the dust and erasing all signs of the shell's fall. It was very, very likely those faint tracks in the dust would never have been detected by satellites, and if another crawler had time to drive from the base to examine the area, the operation would have failed by then. But paying close attention to tiny details is a big part of what made Special Operations troops special, and he was pleased to see a new and inexperienced team member having the presence of mind to take care of small details no one might ever notice. The team picked up the dead bodies of the Bosphorok, surprisingly heavy in the low gravity and awkward because their knees bent the wrong way. Smythe was pleased to see Skippy had been entirely correct about the accuracy of the shots. Both aliens had been double-tapped center mass in their chests, where their suits leaked less air that might be detected. Because they had fallen backward, the blood seeping out before the suits sealed the leaks was contained to the front of their suits, with none dripping down to discolor the gray ground. A shot in the back or head would have caused unacceptable leakage of air, blood, or other fluids. Smythe knew the accuracy of the shots was not entirely due to the advanced technology of their Krestang weapons, and he planned to acknowledge the skill of the snipers. Later. Recognition would come later, after the op was successfully completed and they were enjoying gin and tonics aboard their pirate ship. The clever device that entangled the treads had released itself and fallen into Frey's hands on a command from Skippy. Smythe briefly joined her to inspect there was no damage to the treads before ordering the team into the crawler. With the team were three combots, one of them utilized only to carry the bulky stealth field generator that would be used to encompass the entire moon base. The combot's upper section had been removed, leaving only the chassis and with the generator strapped onto it. Regardless of whether the combot's chassis carried a weapon package or some other burden, they could not fit through the side airlock. So Skippy had ordered the crawler to suck its cabin air back into reservoirs, then swung up the large back door. The entire team, followed by the combots, stomped up the ramp, after which the door closed and resealed. Skippy instructed the air pressure back to normal, then increased it 7% so it matched the pressure at 1 kilometer altitude on Earth for the health and comfort of the star team. Katie Frey wrinkled her nose when she took off her helmet inside the crawler, and not because it still itched.
Oh, God, what is that smell?
You too?
Marine Raider Ed Burke asked, sticking his tongue out like he was gagging.
That, Skippy announced happily through the micro-wormhole in Smythe's pack, is eau de toilette. In this case, it should be pronounced toilet, otherwise known as the natural musky essence of the Bosphorok. They are known far and wide across the galaxy as a smelly species. What your noses are objecting to is the scent glands they use to...
I am fairly certain none of us is going to die from the smell, Smythe remarked dryly.
No, we'll just wish we did, Frey said under her breath. How does the beer can know what we're smelling in here? Rourke asked. Can you detect scents through that wormhole?
No, I cannot, Skippy replied with a haughty sniff. I made a logical deduction. Referring to me as the beer can is not going to win you any points with...
Move now, argue later, Smythe cut the chatter.
While keeping the asshole AI amused was an important part of any mission, it could not be allowed to delay the operation.
Nunnally, Grugian, you take first shift as drivers. Go forward and check out the cockpit. I want us moving in...
He checked the display on his wrist.
2 minutes. Skippy, the ruse is still working?
It is working perfecto, of course. The base is seeing an image of the two knuckleheads removing the junk stuck in the treads. They're all proud that it is a quick and simple fix, and are assuring the base they will be moving again shortly. The base duty officer is telling them to move their asses. If it is so simple, it should be done by now. Those knuckleheads would be in big trouble right now if, you know, they weren't dead. I am such an asshole sometimes.
Smythe looked around in dismay at the crawler's cabin, which was empty except for a streaked coating of gray moon dust on every surface. The Bosphorak crews had not been fastidious about washing the dust off the boots when they returned to the vehicle. Smythe's team had dust clinging to the boots and calves of their suits. They also had not used the decontamination feature of the airlock. But his team had the very understandable reason of being in rather a hurry. The crawler crew had no such excuse for their sloppiness.
Skippy, will breathing this dust present a problem?
Long term, it would be a health hazard. Although if you are on this moon more than 1 day, a Bosphorak missile is more likely to endanger your health. The dust will be an irritant to your throat, lungs, and especially your eyes. I suggest you breathe through your nose and use lubricant eye drops. If needed, the team can close their helmet faceplates and breathe filtered air without depleting your suit oxygen reserves.
Breathing filtered air would also take care of the odor.
Smythe nodded and swung his faceplate down, eye-clicking to instruct the suit to pull cabin air through the filters. His own eyes had been watering, and even he had become a bit dizzy from the unique stench of the Bosphorak. He nodded permission for the team to seal up their helmets.
"It is rather rank in here," he admitted.
A good leader considered his team's personal comfort an important factor in combat readiness.
"Drivers, move when you are ready. Everyone sit on the floor and brace yourselves. From what I saw of this crawler, the ride could get bumpy."